Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Not long ago in human history, wars were fought with sticks, slings, and rocks. Now, with the ability to modify the DNA of disease-causing organisms, war is very different. Evidence is appearing that genetically engineered war has in fact been used in our world. This program, originally recorded and broadcast in September of 1998, is part of a series on environmental and social effects of genetically engineered war. Our guest in this archive edition is Dr. Ron Epstein, a research professor at the Institute of World Religions in Berkeley, California, now retired from the Department of Philosophy at San Francisco State University in San Francisco, California. Professor Epstein and I discussed the scientific and ethical dangers of genetic engineering. Ron, what is known about the use of genetic engineering in warfare?
We're just beginning to find out, Barry, about some very, very scary things that have been going on. One of the key people in bringing this to the attention of the not only the American public, but to the public at large is a fellow named Richard Preston, who many of us know because of his best-selling book, The Hot Zone, about the Ebola virus. He came out with two publications which are very, very interesting. One was in the New Yorker. It was called Annals of Warfare, the Bioweaponeers. And in that book, he talked about what the Soviet Union and now the Russians are doing in this field.
What are they doing?
Well, back in the 70s, we had a treaty with the Soviet Union outlawing biowarfare, and we thought that the Russians were adhering to this treaty. Also, most of the experts in the United States thought that biowarfare could not be very effective. In other words, that these biological organisms that cause people to get sick could not be used effectively on the battlefield, they could not be delivered, and they could not live for a long enough period to have an effect in modern warfare. Both those assumptions turned out to be untrue. When the Soviet Union started falling apart, we got some high-level defectors from their program, and we found that during all these years, they had been going full speed ahead. They had 32,000 scientists working on biowarfare programs, including very, very cutting-edge experimentation in the use of genetic engineering in biowarfare and in delivery systems to make them effective.
What is known about what's been going on in other countries beyond the Soviet Union? Kind of give us a global picture of the scientific development, if you can.
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about what's going on in the Soviet Union, because it's really fascinating. And they took, for example, let me give you two examples. They took the Ebola virus, okay, and they genetically engineered it into smallpox virus. In other words, that they cut out the virulent part of the DNA of the Ebola virus and stuck it in the smallpox virus in such a way that the smallpox was not made less virulent, so that if this new virus, this new genetically engineered virus, was used in biowarfare, then the people who were exposed to it would first get smallpox, a full case of smallpox, and then they would get Ebola on top of that. Another thing they did was to take equine encephalitis virus, which humans can also get, and put that into the smallpox virus too.
And this affects people even if they've been vaccinated against smallpox? Or we don't know?
Yes, because the smallpox vaccination is only good against traditional smallpox, and there's no evidence that that vaccination works also against the genetically engineered virus, because while they're tinkering with the DNA, they can change the DNA very, very easily in such a way so that the vaccines are not effective.
Describe what equine encephalitis is that humans can get.
It's very similar to the regular encephalitis virus, you know, so that people, it's an inflammation of the brain, basically, that very often leads to death.
So you're saying that the changes have already been made, and they're already encapsulated or in storage in the former Soviet Union somewhere?
Well, nobody really knows. That's what's interesting. We had the head of the program, who was directing all of these 32,000 scientists, defect to the United States, I believe, in the late 1980s or early 1990s. And in Preston's article in The New Yorker, he talks both with this guy, who is the head of the programs in the Soviet Union, and his buddy, who was the head of retired head of the CIA programs. And so the two of them talk with Preston about what was going on and what the dangers are. Now, one of the things that has happened is, since the breakdown of the Soviet Union, a lot of those scientists have disappeared. And a lot of that material, not only these two, but a lot of the other stuff that they were working on has disappeared. Another thing that they were working on is genetically engineered anthrax vaccine. For example, many of us have heard in the news that there are plans for the Pentagon to vaccinate our troops against anthrax.
With some soldiers protesting.
Right.
And being told they'll be strapped down if they object to the receipt of the injection.
Well, I think they have good reason to protest, Barry, because it's really a very, very stupid plan.
Tell us. Why?
Because the anthrax vaccine only works against traditional strains of anthrax. And the Soviet Union has already genetically engineered anthrax so that the vaccine is not effective. And even if we develop another vaccine to counter the new genetically engineered anthrax, they can very, very easily do another genetic engineering so that vaccine doesn't work.
They are the scientists who were handling the DNA, who were altering the strains.
That's right. Where are these scientists? We really don't know. Of the 32,000 scientists who were working in the Soviet Union, there are a small number who are still working for Russia. The others have probably been hired. Some probably been hired by the United States. Some by Iraq, Iran, Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea. Nobody really knows where these scientists have gone. Nobody really knows where these genetically engineered bioweapons have gone.
So if we were to talk about the threat to other nations of genetically engineered warfare, what would we say? Germs recognize no boundaries.
That's
the wind
right.
Recognizes no boundaries.
That's right. If you have a virus, a common influenza virus, it can go around the world in less than 2 weeks. In other words, we hear about Hong Kong flu, for example. That ordinary virus, because of all the international travel that goes on, can make it all the way around the globe in less than 2 weeks.
It travels through people traveling,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the wind blowing it,
mm-hmm.
or the air currents
mm-hmm.
carrying it.
Mm-hmm. So, if you have a genetically engineered virus that's being used for biowarfare, and people don't get sick immediately so that they have to be hospitalized on the spot and don't travel, then nobody knows where it's going to go.
Because someone can be incubating the virus for 10 days
uh-huh.
and go a long distance.
That's right.
I think Richard Preston gives that example in the opening to his New Yorker article.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of somebody who gets sick on the way back from Europe.
Right, right. Good point. So Preston talks about this way of transmitting the genetically engineered viruses. He also talks about the fact that the Soviet Union now Russia, developed ways to use airborne dispersal of genetically engineered organisms on a battlefield. And this is something that our government didn't think was possible to do, but they've developed techniques so that they can do it. Now, of course, the one place in the world where this has probably happened is in Iraq. And I think that's one of the things that hasn't been clear in the news. We've been hearing week in and week out for years now about the Iraqis using chemical and biological weapons, but there's been very, very little specifically said about their genetically engineering these weapons.
About where the factories are. Are they in Iraq or are they elsewhere?
They're in Iraq. And the problem is, the same factories that can be used for peaceful uses of genetic engineering, for example, to develop vaccines, genetically engineered vaccines and so on, can very easily be switched over to military use.
So in other words, the same skills that can be used for development of genetic engineered vaccine can be used for genetic engineering in warfare.
That's right.
This issue of airborne dispersal concerns me. Tell us more.
What this means is that they can take a genetically engineered organism or even an ordinary biowarfare organism, and they found a way, we don't know the details yet, so that they can put it in an airplane or low-flying airplanes and spray it over large areas. And the concentration is enough so that all the troops will get sick. Also, one of the big questions in the Gulf War is whether the Iraqis used biological weapons, whether genetically engineered or not, in their missiles. And it seems pretty clear now that they probably did. There's an interesting fellow, Dr. Garth Nicholson, who a number of years ago looked into the possibilities of the use of genetically engineered weapons in the Gulf War.
Do you know what he found?
It's an interesting story. Dr. Nicholson was a professor at the medical school at the University of Texas and had very good credentials. And he had a daughter-in-law, I believe, who was in the Gulf War and got Gulf War syndrome. And since she was having troubles with this, he used his research capabilities to look into it and found something in her blood which looked very much like a genetically engineered substance. It's something called mycoplasma. Now, mycoplasma is an organism which doesn't have any cell walls, which is usually found in blood and is harmless. But in her blood, he found that evidence that this mycoplasma had been genetically engineered.
I want to take a moment and say that you're listening to Radio Curious, brought to you on World Radio. Our guest this week is Professor Ron Epstein, a research professor at the Institute of World Religions in Berkeley, California, and a lecturer in the philosophy department at San Francisco State University in San Francisco, California. We're discussing the scientific and ethical dangers of genetic engineering in warfare. What does this tell us, Ron, when we find these genetically engineered mycoplasmas in a person's blood? What does this indicate as to that person and the larger world?
Well, what Dr. Nicholson tried to do then was to figure out what the possibilities were for how this genetically engineered mycoplasma got into her blood. And this is a very, very interesting story, which is not clear yet. What he found out was that a large percentage of Gulf War veterans who were, not all of them, but who were complaining of Gulf War illness had these mycoplasma in their blood.
And the normal person didn't.
Right. Okay. Now, the other thing that he found out was that this was contagious. and that the incubation period was 6 months to a year. So we were talking before about the dangers of genetically engineered biowarfare that had a long incubation period. Now, Dr. Nicholson himself contracted the same disease that his daughter-in-law had, this Gulf War illness caused by this genetically engineered mycoplasma. Fortunately, he found out that this disease could be treated by a fairly common antibiotic. And so that's a good sign in this case. Other kinds of genetically engineered biowarfare cannot be treated so easily. If we go back to Richard Preston for a moment, in order to popularize his findings, he wrote a novel called The Cobra Event, I believe. And this Cobra Event novel was about an unbalanced geneticist who was working for a U.S. company who decides to use genetically engineered biowarfare to kill off large numbers of the population in a United States city. President Clinton got a hold of this novel, The Cobra Event, and read it, and was completely freaked out. And so what he did was he called in his staff of experts and said, "Is this for real?" And the majority of them said, "Yes." Okay.
Let's back up and describe what the majority said was for real.
Uh-huh.
What are the possibilities that were set out in the Cobra Event fiction?
Basically, what happens is there is a genetically engineered bioweapon that is developed. The plot of the novel is a little more complicated than this, but for our purposes, and this one scientist is able to get a hold of this, and using the subway system of a major American city has plans to spread it through the subway system so that everybody who's using the subway is going to get exposed to this and die, basically.
And Clinton was told that this can actually happen.
That's right. Now,
and then the story moves on.
Yeah.
Tell us.
Quite interesting. As far as we can piece together from what's been announced by the government, the next major thing they did was to test the civil defense capabilities of the United States against genetically engineered bioweapons. And I think what they did was to use the notion that Preston mentions of the Soviet Union developing smallpox genetically engineered with Ebola, so that they had a kind of test scenario which they ran on the southwest border of the United States. What if somebody released this genetically engineered smallpox with Ebola on the border of the southwest border of the United States? Would our current defense capabilities and civil defense capabilities be able to handle this?
And the answer is?
An abysmal failure. Total inability to do anything about it.
Describe what we learned, what came out of these tests.
What we found out was that we are completely unprepared to deal with these genetically engineered bioweapons. And that not only are we completely unprepared, but they are extremely difficult to defend against.
Well, this goes back to the fact that wind knows no borders.
Mm-hmm. Wind knows no borders. People know no borders. Water knows no borders. There are all kinds of ways in which these, depending on their nature, these genetically engineered bioweapons can be spread. You could use other genetic engineering kinds of techniques to attack a country. For example, you could use genetically engineered bacteria to sterilize the soil of a country so that they would no longer be able to effectively grow crops there. That's another thing that could be done. You could tailor genetically engineered bioweapons to a particular ethnic group so that it would just attack a particular ethnic group and wipe them out.
In other words, people who have a certain DNA because of their ethnicity, their genetic ethnicity.
Right.
Sounds awful.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
And there's no control over this if someone has the knowledge and wants to be an outlaw, a genetic outlaw.
It's getting more and more dangerous, Barry. The official response of the U.S. government in terms of protecting the troops has been to push vaccination, and it's been very clear that this is not effective. Now, why have they been pushing vaccination? This is interesting, too. One of the main advisors to the government has a lot of money invested in a company that produces vaccines.
Can you be specific?
I don't have the information right now, but this came out in the news that there was a conflict of interest, and this is a growing problem with geneticists because the overwhelming number of them are no longer objective. They all have tremendous financial stakes in startup companies in which they are invested, and so they can no longer be trusted to give objective advice to the government or to legislatures or legislators or whatever.
So where then can the average person like us and our listeners go to get good information on how to protect ourselves?
I don't think anybody in the whole world has any good information on how to protect ourselves. It's a Pandora's box situation, and I think that's what's so scary about it. That unlike nuclear energy, where you need very, very expensive equipment to build a bomb, you need to get a hold of the nuclear material and so on and so forth, producing bioweapons, genetically engineered bioweapons, is very cheap. It doesn't take very expensive equipment. And probably in 5 or 10 years, students in a high school biology lab will be able to develop their own genetically engineered bioweapons. Now, one of the things that's ironic about the Clinton administration approach to this is, on the one hand, Clinton is now very, very worried about the possibility of an attack on the United States using these weapons. And that's basically the worry, I think, about Iraq, that they can use genetically engineered bioweapons against U.S. troops, either in Iraq or through terrorism in the United States. On the one hand, he's very worried about that, and on the other hand, he has completely gutted the regulatory mechanisms for genetic engineering research on the commercial level. Not completely, but almost so. So,
can you describe what's been done on that level?
Basically, what the Clinton administration has done is to cave into the multinational corporations who have staked their financial future on genetic engineering. And these corporations, we're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars in the very near future. And so these corporations have lobbied the Clinton administration to cut down any kind of regulation, any kind of consideration of long-term safety of genetic engineering to a bare, very, very inadequate minimum. And since that same technology that they're using for peaceful commercial uses of genetic engineering can be very easily transferred to the warfare uses, what they've done on the one hand is to cut down almost all the controls for the peaceful uses, and by doing so they've cut down almost all the controls for the warfare uses, and our government is bullying the rest of the world to go along with this.
Ron, you're a professor of philosophy. Is it better to describe as you are now what's occurred so that people know and know that these terrible threats are out there about which the average person can do nothing? Or is it better to let them go unsaid?
I think there are two sides to this, Barry. On the one hand, the extent to which you publicize what's going on plants seeds in the minds of unstable people and gives them the idea that this is something maybe
that they too can destroy
further
the world.
Their fantasies. Yeah. On the other hand, I think our whole way of life and our whole form of government is predicated on the notion of an informed electorate of citizens. And I think unless the ordinary man and woman in the street know about this, then they're not going to pressure our government to take whatever steps can still be taken to lessen the dangers to the extent that they can be lessened. Now, no matter what we do, it's going to be very dangerous. But clearly, the more the public is aware of what the dangers are, the more the public insists upon controls not only on warfare research using genetic engineering, but also commercial research using genetic engineering, the better off we'll be.
Professor Ron Epstein, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And in the remaining few seconds we have left, is there another book in addition to The Cobra Event by Richard Preston that you could give us a title to?
Sure. There's a pioneer in informing the public about the dangers of genetic engineering in general, whose name is Jeremy Rifkin. And he's just come out with a new book called Biotech Century. And this is an excellent summary, both positive and negative, of what's going on in the world of genetic engineering, including biowarfare.
Ron Epstein, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. Dr. Ron Epstein is a research professor at the Institute of World Religions in Berkeley, California, and retired from the philosophy department at San Francisco State University in San Francisco, California. The books he recommends are The Cobra Event by Richard Preston and Biotech Century by Jeremy Rifkin. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.